Your headlines for this hour: Iran once again calls on Afghanistan's Taliban government to allow expert visits to a dam built on the Hermon River instead of issuing political statements. Hamas slams the Israeli Knesset's bill to ban flying Palestinian flags, saying it reveals the regime's fascist agenda and its declaration of war against Palestinians. The UN says Sudan's warring parties have committed serious violations of a humanitarian agreement signed last week to spare civilians and civilian infrastructure. Iran has once again called on Afghanistan's Taliban government to allow technical teams to inspect a dam built on the Hermon River, which is shared between the two countries. Afghan authorities claim the river does not have enough water to be shared with Iran. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said, despite frequent calls from Iran, the Taliban government has not yet allowed Iranian experts to visit the dam. He added that the main criterion for confirming the lack of enough water behind the dam is technical and objective inspections by experts, not issuing political statements. His remarks came after the Taliban government once again claimed in a statement that the river does not have enough water to be shared with Iran. It also described frequent demands for the country's water share by Iranian officials as harmful. Earlier on Thursday, Iran's president issued a stern warning to the Afghan government, asking Kabul to give the people of Iran's Sistan and Balochistan province their rights. Under a 1973 treaty, Afghanistan has to share waters of the Hermon River with Iran. But the Iranian Energy Ministry has repeatedly accused Afghan authorities of failing to meet their commitments. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says the Islamic Republic and Pakistan are determined to expand their bilateral cooperation.
The two countries are set to further upgrade these relations to increase them from the current level by enjoying the necessary technology and know-how. Major steps have been taken. We are fully prepared to further deepen our relations with our neighboring country, Pakistan, in the energy sector. We can take further and larger steps in this field.
Raisi was speaking at the inauguration ceremony of a new electricity transmission line between Iran and Pakistan. The new power line will allow the annual volume of electricity trade between the two countries to reach 200 megawatts. Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif was present at the inauguration ceremony in Iran's southeastern province of Sistan and Balochistan. He also hailed the project and expressed hope for the enhancement of bilateral cooperation between the two nations. Earlier, the leaders of Iran and Pakistan also inaugurated a market at their joint border crossing. Iran's foreign minister says the measures taken by Israel's extremist and occupying regime pose a serious threat to regional peace and security. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a phone call with Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres. He was referring to Israel's latest aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip. Amir Abdollahian said Palestinian resistance groups will not tolerate Israel's inhumane measures and will give a strong response to them. Israel attacked Gaza for 5 days, beginning on May 9th. The onslaught claimed more than 30 lives, women and children included. According to Palestinian officials, the Israeli aggression displaced more than 450 families, including more than 1,000 children and nearly 700 women. The Hamas resistance movement slams an initial reading of a bill by Israeli Knesset to ban flying Palestinian flags. Hamas in a statement said the bill shows insistence of the regime on its fascist agenda and is a declaration of war against Palestinians. It added the bill will not scare Palestinians, but will rather encourage them to carry and raise their national flag, which represents their identity everywhere. Hamas also called on the international community and the UN to condemn Israeli atrocities against Palestinian people. This comes after passing of an initial reading of a bill sponsored by a far-right Knesset member. The bill would make flying a Palestinian flag punishable by a year in jail if passed in law or into law. The new bill is part of a series of Israeli right-wing initiatives to crack down on Palestinians. Meanwhile, a large number of Israeli settlers backed by the regime forces have broken into Al-Aqsa Mosque compound to hold the so-called flag march. The settlers rallied through the compound and other parts of Al-Quds' old city to observe the event, which marks the regime's capture of Eastern Al-Quds in 1967. Itamar Ben-Gvir, an extreme right member of the Israeli cabinet, has also attended the rally. The occupation forces and settlers have attacked Palestinians in the old city. The Israeli police have also assaulted activists trying to prevent settlers from attending the flag march by blocking a road leading to Al-Quds. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a protest against the flag march, which they view as a highly provocative act. Reports say Israeli forces have attacked the protesters near the eastern borders of Gaza City and injured several Palestinians. Similar protests were also held in the West Bank city of Nablus in support of Al-Quds. The Palestinian Authority earlier warned that holding a rally would fuel tensions in the occupied territories and Israel will be fully responsible for any possible escalation. A spokesman for the Islamic Jihad movement has also said the Israeli regime cannot defeat Palestinians through these measures. He said the Palestinians' fight against the regime will not stop unless Israel is wiped off the map. Ismail Haniyeh, the leader of the Hamas resistance movement, has commented on the issue as well. He said the regime's massive deployment of security forces to Al-Quds shows it is fearful of acts of resistance by Palestinians. Ashraf Shannon earlier joined us on a reporting on protests by Palestinians in the besieged area against the flag march and the desecration of Islamic sanctities by Israeli settlers in Al-Quds.
Thousands of people are currently taking part in a peaceful protest in Gaza. They call it also the flag march. Thousands of people in Gaza City are currently hoisting the Palestinian flag very close to the security fence with the Israeli regime to express their dismay and anger at the move by the Israeli settlers to desecrate and hold the flag march in Al-Quds, while Israeli forces started firing rubber-coated metal bullets as well as tear gas canisters, hundreds of tear gas canisters at the protesters. Already at least a dozen people have been injured so far in this peaceful activity. Many here in Gaza expect some sort of escalation from the Palestinian factions in Gaza, not because of anything that's happening right now, but because of the fact that the Israeli regime and Israeli extremist Jewish settlers have desecrated the Al-Aqsa compound today.
Let's go to Sudan, and the United Nations has condemned the warring parties for serious violations of a humanitarian agreement signed last week. The deal requires both sides to spare civilians and civilian infrastructure and to let in badly needed humanitarian aid. The UN aid chief said there have been important and egregious breaches of the agreement since it was signed. Martin Griffiths particularly pointed to a recent attack on the World Food Programme office in the Sudanese capital, amongst many examples. He stressed the need for scaling up assistance to Sudan dramatically to deal with what he called the spiraling situation in the country. The Sudan conflict erupted on April 15th between Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and his former deputy Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, who leads the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. According to the UN official, around 1,000 people have been killed in and around the capital Khartoum and in the western region of Darfur. Griffiths added that more than a million people have also been displaced by the ongoing battles. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is in Saudi Arabia to attend an Arab League summit there. This is the first such trip by the Syrian president to Saudi Arabia since the breakout of the foreign-backed militancy in Syria in 2011. The trip follows Arab League adoption of a resolution in Cairo to readmit Syria to the bloc after nearly 12 years of its suspension. Our correspondent Mohammed Ali joined us earlier with more details.
However, we have to note that in the past couple of 2 days, there were some preparatory meetings by Arab officials for that summit. We know that what is very important, according to many analysts, is not the summit itself, but perhaps separate bilateral meetings that will happen on the sidelines, especially with regards to Syria. Now, we know that the many Arab countries have started restoring back diplomatic ties with Syria. This is perhaps the first kind of presence for the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, in which there are so many Arab leaders that he could meet. And this is very important. Also, we have to wait and see if there will be kind of a meeting between the Syrian president and Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other Saudi officials. Just yesterday, there was a meeting between the Syrian and Saudi foreign ministers on the sidelines of that Arab League summit, and they both confirmed that the two leaderships are serious in moving forward with the relations between the two countries, and that very soon we'll be witnessing the opening of the embassies in both countries. In general, it's a very important and historic event. The Arab League will be discussing many issues, many crises in this region.
Former British ambassador to Syria Peter Ford joined us earlier with his take on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's recent trip to Saudi Arabia to attend the Arab League summit. Let's take a listen.
It signals the success of Syria with its allies, Iran and Russia, in overcoming Western attempts to overthrow the regime of Syria. It also signals a changed role for Saudi Arabia. And this is possibly even more important on a geopolitical level, that Saudi Arabia should defy the United States on this major issue. And the Americans have put a lot of pressure on Saudi and other Arab countries not to normalize relations with Syria. The Saudis have defied the Americans on this. They defied the Americans on reaching an agreement recently with Iran to lower tensions. They defied America over oil prices recently. Really, there has been almost a diplomatic revolution here. America is no longer alone in calling the shots in the Middle East.
South Koreans opposed the U.S. pressure looming at the G7 on South Korea to cooperate with Japan said the U.S.-led trilateral alliance with Japan needs to take a backseat and Tokyo must come to terms with history first. Activists gathered for a press briefing in Seoul, critical of the U.S.-led G7 taking place in Hiroshima. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
The Japanese city of Hiroshima is set to host a G7 summit this week, where leaders of the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Canada, Italy, and Japan will address pressing global issues. The meeting is also a source of controversy in other countries around the world, including South Korea, where activists at a Seoul forum slammed the event as diplomatic whitewashing.
This summit is a tool to conceal the terrible truth that countless Asian and Pacific people had to bleed due to 50 years of Japanese imperialism beginning in the late 19th century. It's a blindfold to cover Japan's hypocritical steps towards a nuclear-free world, peace, and rearmament, while dumping nuclear-contaminated water and scrapping its peace constitution.
South Korea's relations with Japan have always been controversial, but especially now as President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to improve ties against the wishes of many South Koreans, who demand an apology for what they call Japan's colonial abuses. As world leaders flock to Hiroshima, South Koreans are reminded of a history the U.S. and Japan might rather forget. when the U.S. dropped the atomic bombs on Japan. In addition to more than 200,000 Japanese, estimates suggest some 40,000 Koreans were killed. Many of them were forced laborers.
Some South Koreans say President Yoon is moving the country too close to the United States and a military alliance with Japan, which is seen as increasing regional tension. Japanese leader Fumio Kishida invited Yoon to the G7.
The South Korean government's participation is mainly to strengthen military cooperation between South Korea, the U.S., and Japan, and further strengthen military cooperation with NATO, which is mainly led by the United States. If South Korea's participation in the G7 was to reinforce the military alliance as a benefit, that can never be a good thing for the peace of the Korean Peninsula, as well as world peace.
While the summit plans to address the Russia-Ukraine war and economic issues, activists also argue the rich G7 nations need to do more to solve the humanitarian crisis now unfolding in East Africa. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The UK Treasury says the British government has spent £162 million, which amounts to more than $200 million, on the Queen's state funeral and related events. According to the report, the biggest costs were covered by the Home Office, the Department of Culture, Media and Sport. Our correspondent in London, Saipul Reza, has more on the story.
As far as the sentiments, well, such expenditure in other circumstances may not have been as big a problem as they are now, because people are increasingly saying that this is at odds with the cost of living crisis, with the economic crisis and realities that people are experiencing on a day-to-day basis. And they have taken to social media to vent their anger and frustration on that. This is a time when one in five people in Britain, that's 14.5 million people, are currently living in poverty. And more people, as we've been reporting for months now, for over a year, an increasing number of people relying on food banks in order to eat. So some people are saying, why is it that we have to foot the bill for a funeral of that scale while we have to pay for our own funeral?
Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A barrage of climate fuel disasters in the U.S. has slowed down federal tax collection just when it's needed the most. The reports that a series of climate catastrophes have exacerbated the debt ceiling crisis in the United States. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. truth out road in this regard, as President Joe Biden tangles with Republican lawmakers over whether to raise the nation's debt ceiling, a key question looms over the negotiations. When exactly will the U.S. government run out of money? No one knows the answer, but one factor is making it harder to pin down: climate change. A barrage of climate fuel disasters has slowed down the pace of federal tax collection, pushing the government closer to an unprecedented default on its debt this summer. There are countless factors that determine how much tax revenue the federal government receives on any given day, but one major factor this year is climate change. The past year saw more than a dozen billion-dollar disasters in as many states, and the Internal Revenue Service has offered tax relief to residents of these states, giving them an extra few months to file their taxes. The worst affected states include Florida and California, which suffered respectively from Hurricane Ian and a series of atmospheric river storms this winter. Together, the two states account for more than a quarter of federal revenues. Because millions of American taxpayers have been able to delay their filings due to disasters, the federal government is receiving less money than it otherwise would at this time of year. In ordinary circumstances, this would not be a problem, since the government borrows money to make up for an uneven balance between tax revenue and spending, usually by issuing bonds. But because the U.S. has reached its self-imposed debt ceiling, an arbitrary limit on how much of that borrowing the government can do, the fate of the global economy depends on how much cash the Treasury receives over the next few weeks. This limit was established around a century ago, and Congress has raised it dozens of times, typically without controversy. But in recent years, Republicans have seized on debt ceiling authorization as high a stakes way to extract concessions that they don't have the votes to pass through Congress. Since assuming control of the House of Representatives this year, Republicans have refused to endorse the customary debt ceiling increase unless Biden agrees to cuts in federal spending that have already been appropriated by Congress. Though the exact conditions that will satisfy enough Republicans to vote for an increase are unclear, a variety of controversial options are on the table, including a repeal of Inflation Reduction Act, the climate law intended to keep the U.S. in line with its Paris Agreement targets. The U.S. reached the current debt limit in January. Since then, the U.S. Treasury Department has been paying daily bills using only the cash it has on hand. If lawmakers don't raise the debt ceiling soon, the Treasury will run out of cash and have no choice but to default on its debt. This would have disastrous and unprecedented consequences. Veterans and Social Security recipients would miss payments. Borrowing costs for credit cards and mortgages could jump, and global financial markets would enter a tailspin. Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met this week to discuss a debt ceiling increase. But a big problem for both sides is that no one knows for sure when the Treasury will run out of cash. Treasury officials have said that a default could arrive as early as June 1st, but the federal government is so large that it's impossible to predict how much money it will receive from taxes any given day. The best that officials can do is give a ballpark estimate of when the so-called X date of default will arrive. Federal disaster declarations have made that prediction even more difficult. The disaster declarations are playing a heightened role in determining the X date because they are shifting normal revenue patterns of the government and spreading them across the year, as opposed to truncating them into tax season, said Rachel Sinderman, a senior associate director for economic policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center, a nonprofit think tank that has been studying the debt ceiling timeline. Sinderman said this uncertainty wouldn't be a big deal, saying if lawmakers had started negotiating a debt limit increase earlier in the year. But with the X date now potentially just weeks away, the ups and downs of federal revenue collection have become extremely important. A few extra days of revenue could mean the difference between a safe resolution and a chaotic default. If the government can make it to June 15th without running out of money, it will receive a large chunk of cash from quarterly tax filings, which should stabilize revenue for a few weeks. Then, at the end of June, the Treasury will be able to access another $143 billion in borrowing authority, which could help stave off default until the beginning of August. But if May tax revenues remain lower than projected, the government will never reach that mid-June revenue influx at all. Without a debt limit increase, an X date is inevitable. But the revenue delays could push that date earlier and earlier, heightening the risk of default. John Ball, spokesperson for the Tax Policy Center, a nonpartisan think tank, said, "Shifting the breach date a few days one way or the other is important this close to finish the line. Though they are hardly the biggest factor in the debt ceiling crisis, this is why the disaster delays matter. By failing to raise the debt limit, Congress has made the government vulnerable to every little bump in tax revenue, and climate change has created quite a few bombs."
Food for thought.
Salam, and we start the day by contemplating upon a valuable piece of advice from the Prophet's infallible successor, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him. Three characteristics bring about hatred, that is, hypocrisy, oppression, and self-conceit.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything.
باید فهمیم.
We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
و آنگاه پیاده کردن این مفاهیم در واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to get rid of the memories of my childhood. In the name of God, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful, may His peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and His pure Immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Salamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z, IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, and I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to have you with me for this program. We're going to start our program with a very important question. Someone has said that the memories of my childhood and the problems of my family that led to this physical abuse and then to a divorce of my father and mother and the misfortunes that followed distressed me. I do not know how to forget them. Whenever I remember them, I become so distressed so that I lose my composure and I faint. There is no doubt that these things exhaust man's strength and abilities, which he needs for success in his future. Would you please tell me how to be rid of this state? Very severe, actually, situation. For answering this question, one of the most important bases of raising children is the relationship between parents, which is based on love, respect, and mutual understanding and cooperation. It gives children spiritual and mental stability, and this is what you have lost in your childhood. However, this does not mean that you should apply to your life what happened to your parents. Everyone has an independent will, and his punishment also near Allah does not have anything to do with others' punishments. So if you agree with me on this belief, which is the fact in our true religion, you should do the following principles. I'm going to count you, and these principles are taken from Quran and Hadith. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A2Z, IRB English Radio, Call of Islam page. So we were talking about the principles that, with the help of them, we can read off the bad memories of our childhood. So let's count them together. The very first one is to seize any opportunity to build your personality and gain the factors of success in your life. It's quite important, and we can do it by many things actually in our life. But it's a very important title. We need to put it at the beginning of our principles. Secondly, consider any success in your life as a possible of being repeated and reproduced, and do not stop after a certain point or satisfy yourself with what you have achieved. So you always need to look for something bigger, inshallah. And thirdly, know well that man, whatever bitter memories may distress him or press on his nerves, is able to pass over them on condition that he trusts in his mental abilities and relies on his Lord, Allah, the Almighty. And four, do not allow negative memories to overcome your heart. Try to omit them from your memory. Whenever they attack you, busy yourself with reciting the Holy Quran, reciting supplications, reading good books, and remembering your nice memories, or leave your place, or perform ablution, wudu, or ghusl, and walk and ponder over nature, the sky and its stars, the sea and its wonders, the trees and its fruits, the flowers and their fragrances. Also, read books that will help you build a faithful personality and learn the ways that the believers succeeded. And read about the great people in history. You will find that most of them have undergone in their childhood different family and social sufferings like orphanhood, homelessness and injustice. Karbala of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam gave us a great lessons which were completed by Imam Hussein's sister, Sayyidah Zainab alayhi salam, who inspired the spirit of resistance in the orphans and captives, until she turned the apparently victorious into the real defeated. On the other hand, successful discoveries and invention have come after many failed experiments. Then shake off the dust of your memories and extort your success from your parents' failures. I hope everyone a good life. Thank you for staying with us.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Since mid-January, the French government has been facing nationwide protests against its plans to raise the pension age by 2 years to 64. Millions of people have been demonstrating and joining strike action since then to show their opposition to Macron's plan. The protests have intensified since the government used special constitutional powers to bypass Parliament on a final vote on the pension bill.
So the French government decided yesterday to trigger what is known as the Article 49.3 of the Constitution, which is a special power the government has to force a vote, to force a reform through Parliament without a vote. That's something that's within its rights. The government can do it if it wants. Other governments in the past have done it before, but it's political dynamite. And of course, for the government, it's embarrassing because it shows that it hasn't got a majority in Parliament to pass its reforms.
The move has brought scenes of chaos reminiscent of unrest by supporters of the Yellow Vest movement during Macron's first term as president. According to the French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin, 13,000 police had been deployed, 5,500 of them in Paris alone. The French president was supposed to have been hosting King Charles for a day of pomp and ceremony in late March, but had to cancel the state visit because of the demonstrations. On March 28th, even the Eiffel Tower, the symbol of France, closed its doors to visitors as its staff went on strike. The same day, clashes erupted between police and protesters in the western city of Nantes as public anger over pension reforms evolved into broader anti-Macron sentiment. Macron, who promised to deliver a pension system reform in his presidential campaigns, says the reform is needed to keep the country's finances in balance. Unions and opposition parties, on the other hand, say there are other ways to do that. But the problem with the Macron government is that it does not like negotiation. Meanwhile, as workers continue rolling strikes, heaps of garbage in Paris streets have become the symbol of the protests. The crisis has intensified because of controversy over policing tactics, with lawyers complaining of arbitrary arrests, injuries, and heavy-handedness during crowd control. More than 30 lawyers have recently written an open letter to Le Monde, stating their great concern over what they called arbitrary arrests of hundreds of people, accusing the police of using the judicial systems and arrests as a tactic to put people off protesting. Under the leadership of Emmanuel Macron, participating in protests in France today carries the risk of being seriously injured by rubber bullets and other dangerous weapons used by the police, a flagrant violation of human rights. Since 2018, millions of people have taken to the streets in France to demand social and economic justice. The response of the authorities has been to weaponize the law to crack down on peaceful protesters. President Macron has said he has no choice but to implement the pension reform out of economic considerations, but he has not said why he doesn't allow people to protest peacefully.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Oceans have absorbed some 90% of the heat caused by human-induced climate change at a devastating cost. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted, the world's oceans have reached their warmest levels in modern history, outpacing climate forecasts and alarming scientists. Daily ocean temperatures have been trending warmer than normal every day for the past month and a half, approximately. Experts warn the pattern does not bode well for marine life and human well-being. While the difference in temperature between this year and the same period in 2022 comes down to just a few tenths of a degree, looked at over the long term, the increase represents a significant jump. Average sea surface temperatures this spring are roughly 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than they were in 1986, one of the first years that real-time satellite ocean temperature data was available. The oceans are enormous, so they don't warm very quickly ordinarily, Robert Rod, a physicist at the environmental data science nonprofit Berkeley Earth, told Grist, adding, "This is an unusually abrupt rise to a level that's above what it's been at any previous year." The abnormal warmth is especially concerning as the planet's weather patterns shift from a La Nina cycle, which has had a cooling effect on much of the planet for the past 3 years, to an El Nino, which is a harbinger of above-average global temperatures. El Nino is characterized by ocean temperatures in the Pacific Ocean that are between 3 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit above average, but that phenomenon hasn't officially started yet. Experts are still scrambling to figure out what exactly is behind this spike. But there is wide consensus that both El Nino and climate change play a role. Rode said, "It appears at the moment that we are seeing the early stages of an El Nino emerging. And the breadth of area that is affected by that warmth really points to climate change being a factor. Oceans have absorbed a massive amount of carbon dioxide that humans have generated since the Industrial Revolution. In total, oceans have absorbed some 90% of the heat caused by human-induced climate change. But that benefit comes with a devastating cost. The globe's oceans have become warmer and more acidic over time, which has wide-ranging repercussions for marine life and human well-being. Rising ocean temperatures lead to changing circulation patterns. Coral bleaching, sea level rise, changes in fish migration and marine food webs, and ocean deoxygenation when oceanic dead zones form." Scientists have cautioned that the ocean cannot absorb emissions forever. There will come a time when the water bodies grow so warm, they begin to emit carbon dioxide instead of absorbing it. The recent sustained spike in sea surface temperatures throws the long-term viability of the world's oceans into sharp relief. This is heading in an unprecedented direction and could be taking us into uncharted territory. Ben Weber, a professor of climate science at the University of East Anglia, told The Guardian. Meanwhile, the website of Axios reported, "A double whammy of natural climate cycles and human-caused climate change will likely make next year's Earth's warmest on record," climate experts tell Axios. Forecasters now expect that a moderate El Nino, the climate pattern characterized by warmer than usual sea surface temperatures, will develop this summer, bringing sweeping shifts to weather patterns worldwide. El Nino teams up with human-caused climate change and pushes global average surface temperatures higher. Even a relatively weak event could lead to new records for the warmest year in 2023 and 2024. Three straight years of La Nina, which features cooler than usual sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific, have given way to a rapid transition to an El Nino state. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, declared an El Nino watch last week, putting 62% odds of an event setting up during the May to July period. The odds jumped to about 85% later in the year, according to Michel Loro, a meteorologist who leads the El Nino Southern Oscillation Team at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center. The last global record occurred in 2016, which was also an El Nino year. The planet has continued to warm since. The past 8 years were the warmest such period on record. And in just the last few weeks, ocean temperatures reached unprecedented levels. The ocean, an atmospheric climate pattern, also shifts weather across the globe, shutting down much-needed rains for tens of millions while bringing deluges to other areas. El Nino can lead to drier than average conditions in parts of eastern Australia. Wet conditions in East Africa, plus a host of shifts across North America during the fall and winter. Typically, computer models are less accurate in forecasting El Nino events during the spring, which is known as the spring prediction barrier. But Loro told Axios via email that the key precursors to El Nino development are already evident in observations, which makes forecasters more confident. Specifically, we currently are seeing a large amount of subsurface oceanic heat building in the tropical Pacific, which will eventually bubble up to the surface, she explained. In addition, east-to-west trade winds along parts of the equatorial tropical Pacific have slackened somewhat, which is a key ingredient for setting an El Nino into motion and maintaining it, Loro added. Model projections have been leaning toward a moderate to strong El Nino by the fall and winter, notes Zach Hossfather, climate research lead at web payment company Strip. He said these events can boost global temperatures by about 0.2 degrees Celsius on top of the larger, long-term human-caused warming trend. While it's too early to know for sure, it's likely that 2024 will be the warmest year on record. Exactly how warm will depend on how long El Nino conditions persist, Hossfather said. Hossfather echoed Adam Scaife, head of long-range prediction for the UK Met Office. Both say the developing El Nino may cause global average surface temperatures to temporarily come very close to or even briefly reach the Paris Agreement's temperature guardrail of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. This would be a symbolic milestone since the Paris Agreement targets refer to long-term averages, not 1 or 2 years. Perhaps the most important thing is not whether it actually reaches 1.5 degrees Celsius next year, Scaife told Axios via email, adding, but that this will be the first time in history we are within reach of this level for the annual global average temperature. One potentially positive aspect of an El Nino is that they tend to reduce but not eliminate Atlantic Ocean hurricane activity by increasing upper atmospheric winds, which can tear storms apart. In a spate of weather extremes and a new record warm year reverberate politically, the so-called Super El Nino of 2015 to 2016 coincided with the negotiating and adoption of the Paris Agreement. The upcoming UN Climate Summit in Dubai, starting in November, will test whether nations can commit to more aggressive near-term emissions reductions targets or not.
Iranian culture and food. Part 3. Along with language, flag, religion, customs, traditions, and national arts, food and sofre are among the elements that define nations' identities. Food is a delicious part of culture of every nation and is a good measure to determine kindness, generosity, ethics, protection of environment and nature, and the time